Morning, I'm still on East Coast time. Today, we were going to really talk to the audience about hiring trends, market conditions, and the challenges facing information security professionals as they move through their career path, and a career path that's continuing changing, continually evolving. And granted, you know, we're going to want a lot of interaction from the floor. We're here to answer any of the questions that you guys might have, and feel free to raise your hands throughout the presentation. A brief introduction of who I am. My name's Lee Kushner. I run LJ Kushner & Associates. We're an executive search firm. We do nothing but recruit in the field of information security and secure electronic commerce. We've been in business for over 4 years. Our customers include very large software companies, Fortune 500 firms, large consulting organizations, very small product companies, and a lot of managed security service providers. Most of the work that we do is throughout the United States. We do very little work internationally. And a lot of times these organizations come to us when they're starting to build information security organizations, they're starting to build product teams, and when they're starting to build sales and marketing type organizations within the information security arena, and obviously on the Fortune side, when they're looking to go out and hire and build a chief security officer and a chief information security officer. And I want to introduce Fred Ricca over here. And Fred could tell you a little bit about himself.
Thanks, Lee. Good morning as well. We understand that we're the only thing between you and lunch, so we'll make sure that you're out of here in time to get to the buffet. But I'm Fred Ricca. I'm a partner with PricewaterhouseCoopers, a Final Four accounting firm. And my role at PwC is I lead our New York Metro practice, as well as having some responsibility nationally for our threat and vulnerability assessment group. And so I bring an interesting perspective, I think, because on the one hand, I hire lots of IT security professionals. As you might imagine, given the size and scope of what we do, we're always looking for people, and interestingly enough, people are always looking for us. And at the same time, we spend a lot of time helping Fortune 500 companies build their information security functions, and usually what that means is we have to help them define the roles and responsibilities of the types of people that they need, particularly chief security officer type of roles, as well as the people that support him. So I'd like to share with you some observations on the types of people that we like to bring into the consulting world, the types of skills that we look for and we try to nurture, and also talk about what some of the trends are that we see in the private sector, which I think you might be surprised some of the types of skills that our clients are asking us to help them find.
One of the things that I think is very important. One of the things I think is very important before, you know, getting into very specific things about, you know, what skills should I have, what's going to make me more marketable, how do I become a chief security officer? I think some of the things that need to be really understood is why our industry is kind of shaped out the way that it is right now. And typically, and I'll use a Big Four firm as an example, when a company goes out and they want to build an accounting or an auditing type practice, they go to the local universities and say, we want to interview all your accounting majors or all your business majors. They set up 100 in a room. They pick the best 20, and they hire them onto their teams. These career paths continue to grow, and what the shape of that career path is that as they keep going into the organization thins out as it gets to the point, and that person will go up to be, they'll start as an accountant, then they'll maybe project manage, then they might be controller of the business unit, then they then might be the chief financial officer of a business unit, and then all of a sudden they become the chief financial officer of a company. So you wind up with a pyramid shape, and you can almost envision that in your mind. Information security is atypical. You cannot pool all the information security majors in America and get a pool of 100 people to interview and say, I'm going to pick the best 30 to come join my organization. The truth of the matter is that people join the information security profession through a lot of atypical means. A lot of times, information security professionals they get involved because it becomes a passion of theirs. They get involved in chat rooms and user rooms, and they start sharing ideas. They come to conferences like DEF CON when they're 16, 17 years old. And they come out and they start learning. They start associating with people. And then they realize, you know what, I can make money at doing this. But when they come in, a lot of times their first position is not because they were recruited off of a college campus. It's because they know somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody who needs a Unix systems admin who understands information security. So when people start coming into the market in atypical ways, what you see is this, is that you see a point at the bottom, and that's why there's such a lack of information security professionals coming up into organizations. That's why some of the harder skills, the more technical skills that are required in Fortune organizations are so hard to find. Also, the person who's not coming off of the college campus or with all the pedigrees that Fortune organizations are used to hiring, this is the information security professional doesn't necessarily fit the mold of what typical HR functions hire into their organizations. And a lot of times the HR organizations have a very difficult time in adjusting the profile of what it is that they're searching for, because a lot of times, and I'm not picking on HR people are our friends, but a lot of times when they go to hire and they go to look, they really go with a checkbox approach. Does the person have a degree? Do they have 6 years of Unix? Do they have 3 years of Java? Do they, whatever it might be. That's also, that whole checkbox approach is also one of the reasons that internet searching is not really helpful in information security. How many of you have ever posted a resume on a job board? That's it. Wow, that's few. But anyhow, if an organization is starting to look for, say, Java developers, they go on Monster, type in 6 years Java, boom, they spit out a list of 100 people, they see who qualifies, HR starts calling them, and boom, you have a person. In information security, one of the reasons it's so hard to find talent is that there's so many nuances within the profession. So just because somebody is a strong firewall person or strong intrusion detection person doesn't necessarily mean that they have all the skills necessary, architecture, anything that really organizations are searching for.
So then the challenge gets compounded because you reach a certain point in your career. You're compensated at a certain level. You certainly, if you want to make a move or you want to get into information security, you don't want to take a step back. And then HR looks at you and says, well, you know, you have to be a manager. And I need you, not only do you have to have strong technical skills, but I need you to be able to run a business for me, and I need you to be able to manage a team of, you know, whatever it is, 5, 6, 10 people with varying levels of skills and varying degrees of competency. And on top of all that, you need to be able to take that team and what they do and explain it in terms that the CFO, the CEO, the head of internal audit, whoever it might be, can understand. And so what happens is we see that we get caught up in this kind of no man's land between, do I have to, you know, what do I do to keep my technical skills sharp? But at the same time, if I really want to move up the ladder and if I really want my career to progress, I have to start developing some of these soft skills, which almost inherently means that your technical skills will start to degrade over time. And my experience is, you know, in promoting people throughout my organization, that's been the biggest challenge, is getting them to understand that you're not going to be measured solely on your technical skills anymore. You have to let go of that and start to develop good management and people and communication skills.
Well, that point that Fred touches on is great, because I actually like to call it career purgatory. And what happens is, as people move up, they're either technical wizards or they've managed and run departments. And they say, well, how do I make the next step in my career? Well, just because you're a technical wizard and you're the best and the brightest in that area doesn't necessarily mean that you have the management skills capable of, you know, you could have more technical skills at 22, 23, 24 years old than everybody else around you. However, just because you're the best technical go-to person doesn't necessarily mean that you are qualified to go out and run a group or run a department. Yes, you could be technical lead on projects. At the same point in time, there are a lot of people that are in this industry that I almost kind of say have been grandfathered in, and it's not really a pun on time or age, but really people who have actually, they started out, they came into the field as it was developing, a lot of policy and procedure work, and one of the things that you ever ask them to do on interviews, you say, you know, tell me about your hands-on technical skills. Well, I don't get involved in that. Well, I've never had anybody not get a job because they were too technical. I've never had that feedback from a customer. So a lot of times people, when they grow their careers, they say, I think it's important, it's a good thing to say I'm a manager, I'm a director, and they lose touch with the technical aspects of the position. And I think that as people build their career paths, and this is kind of why you have this career purgatory, you have all these technical people who haven't been able to grow their management skills, and you have all these managerial people that have been too darn lazy to keep up with the technical changes in this, you know, in the environment. And if anybody knows anything, I mean, you know, starting recruiting in 1996 in this space, I remember if we found a firewall person, it was like hitting lotto. I mean, like firewall, checkpoint, you know, secure computer, you know, sidewinder, it was great. Now, I mean, firewall skills are, you know, a dime a dozen out there. So the industry continues to evolve, and people have to take their careers and continue to move up to that, you know, into that ladder.
Yeah. Has everyone here heard of legislation called Sarbanes-Oxley? Is everyone right? And you know, without getting into it too much, it's basically legislation that dictates that companies' management is going to take responsibility for the security and control over their processes, their business functions, and their technology. And that's a big deal, because ultimately it could end up meaning jail time for people who lie about the security and control that they have in place. So now what's happening is I'm getting clients coming to me and saying, you know, I now need a chief security officer. I never really had one before. I had some guy in IT, and he seemed to know how to run the firewall and the IDS, and so he was my security officer. Now I need a guy who not only understands the legislative aspects of this, he understands how it relates to my business and my business processes, and then he's got to be a good enough politician and communicator that he can share that information with my board of directors and the CFO and the CEO, because ultimately part of what they're signing off on, they are relying upon the chief security officer to provide them the information they need to make an intelligent decision. That is a far cry from a lot of the work that I've done in my career, and probably a lot of the work that you do right now.
You know, we're talking about the chief security officer role, and I think that organizations right now, there's been a lot, I don't know how much you guys read, and everybody starts pushing, you know, the chief security officer is the new executive position, and everybody's hiring one, and I'm sure you get news blurbs that say, oh, you know, 30% of organizations have a chief security officer, whatever those numbers are. Well, the truth of the matter is that even if somebody is going out and hiring somebody as a chief security officer, one of the challenges that this industry continues to face is that regardless of the legislation that's out there, whether it's Sarbanes-Oxley, whether it's the California law the California state law that passed, HIPAA, Gramm-Leach, Bliley, all those things, until there's enforcement of those laws, until people really start getting punished and people go to jail and people pay fines, what you're going to see, and it's still an undercurrent. Gartner said that security makes up about 6% of IT budgets, 5 or 6% of IT budgets. And if you think about how low that number is, what that should be telling everybody, and that 6% is headcount, software, training, admin, the whole nine yards. What that should be telling people is that boards of directors of these large companies very few and far between of them are really taking information security as seriously as we'd like to think that they would. And one of the key reasons behind that is that there is not any accountability, or at least public accountability, for not investing money in information security. And because, shadowed with the economic times that we've faced in the past two and a half years, what you also see is that unless you can really clearly define a return on investment, people are pushing security kind of off to the side and are looking at different, more cost-effective ways of how do we handle information security? Do we have to add headcount? Do we go out to the consulting firms? You know, 3 years ago when these managed security service providers are coming out, I have a friend of mine that's a chief security officer at a Fortune financial services institution, and he made a very interesting comment to me. He said, Lee, he goes, what do you think the total venture capital commitment is to all these managed security service providers that are out there? And I said, I don't know, about $350 million. He said, call it $500 million. He said, Lee, he said, if I go out and I retain one of these firms to do my security, something happens, and I have a story on the Wall Street Journal, on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. How much do you think that's going to cost my organization? I said, it's got to be more than $500 million. He said, exactly. 2 weeks ago, I get a phone call from the same guy calling me up and saying, what do you think of these three managed security service providers? What kind of people do they hire? So here's somebody who's gone in 3 years completely 180 from there's no way I would think or consider this to our organization is on a complete outsourcing trend, especially from the grunt work and the log collecting and the log filing and everything like that, that we are interested in, we are evaluating managed security service providers.
The other challenge, to add to Lee's point, is that we kind of talk our own language. You know, we have cool things like firewalls and intrusion detection and port scanners and mappers and things like that. And we tend to be insular with our communication. And the problem is the board, the CFO, the CEO, they don't understand that language. What they know is the security guy wants more money for another widget. And I gave him money last year for a bunch of widgets, and he told me that would make us secure. And now he's coming back again this year, and he wants more widgets, because we're not really as secure as we thought we were going to be. So they don't necessarily understand the language that we're talking. And so where I've seen organizations be very successful, and who, by the way, who struggles to get funding for security projects? I mean, right? It's a big problem. And where I've seen organizations be successful, and I'm working with one right now that is going to be very successful, is they've learned to get away from talking about widgets, and they've started to talk about not necessarily return on investment, which is a good thing if you can figure it out. I still haven't figured out how that works. But if you can start to tie what you're doing to the organization's business objectives, what are the five things my company wants to accomplish this year? And then in order to do that, what do we need from a security perspective to make that happen? And one area where PwC has been very successful is selling identity management solutions to some of our larger, you know, Fortune 10 type of clients. And we never go in and talk about firewalls and LDAPs and directory structures. The conversation goes like this. You want an employee self-service portal, and you think that's going to save you $10 million a year if your employees can, you know, get their pay stub online and change their benefits, and if they have a self-service portal. Well, in order to do that, you need security to make sure that employee A can't see employees in B's, you know, information or vice versa. And that's pretty much where the conversation stops, because we can do that for you. We know how to build that, and this is what it's going to cost you. But, you know, it's going to cost you $2 million, but you're going to save $10 million over the next 2 years, and that's the end of the conversation, and we're done, and we move on, and we can do the work, because we've tied it to a business objective, having an employee self-service portal. We've tied it to how much money they're going to save, and we've gotten out of the realm of widgets. We're not talking about firewalls. We're not talking about servers. We're not talking about LDAPs anymore. And that's a big challenge. I see a lot of security officers that I work with struggle because they can't make that leap from how do I get from widgets to how do I get to being tied to my organization's business objectives. And so what happens is when we start to help clients to find chief security officers, a lot of times we're not looking for people who've grown up in information security, or we're looking for people who understand the business, understand business process, understand how to communicate with senior executives. The technologies of the, you know, that's almost easy compared to the other half, being able to communicate how all that technology is going to help our company achieve its business objectives. And people who develop those skills, who can make that leap, I think in the next 4 or 5 years are going to find a lot of opportunities are going to open up for them.
One of the things that, you know, I agree with a lot of the things that Fred says is that, you know, understand, you know, one of the more disheartening things about people growing their careers, that logjam of people who are looking for that next step in their career, they go up for a job and they say, well, who got the position? Well, they gave it to somebody else. It was the general counsel, somebody from the legal counsel or general counsel got the chief security officer position, or somebody from the government, or somebody from the army, somebody from, you know, from non-industry. You know, one of the hardest things about looking for chief security officers and working with customers who are trying to search for the position is really putting together a definition that coincides with what it is that they want to do. A lot of times that position description writing or brainstorming session that you go through with a customer when they're looking for that position is quite intensive. And, you know, some of the things that come out of their mouths, you wouldn't think that were important. Sometimes they ask for people with legal backgrounds, and that'll probably squash out about 98.5% of the information security professionals out there. Some people are looking for folks that have experience in international markets and international laws and import export laws, those types of things. So you see so many different angles for searching for this type of position. It almost becomes very difficult for you guys to say, well, I want to become a chief security officer one day. What do I have to do to become one? And unfortunately, there really is not a clear answer that says, hey, you know, if you do A, B, C, D, E, F, and G, you're going to become the chief security, you'll be qualified to be a chief security officer. I mean, one of the things that's kind of funny is that, I think some of the best chief security officers will come from consultative type backgrounds because they're used to selling the function, they're used to dealing with the different business units, the whole nine yards. The first thing that out of people's mouths in Fortune organizations, they say, I don't want somebody from consulting, I want somebody from industry. And it boggles my mind. You had a question?
Yeah.
The question was, do we see some separation between security function and the IT function? And it's interesting. I spent a couple hours with the CFO of a big payroll company debating this very topic with him. And as counterintuitive as it may sound, I think the trend, Fred Ricker's opinion, the trend is going to be to move that function out of IT and more back into the business. And I think there's two reasons for that. One is, IT controls the IT money, and if the security guy is asking for more money or more resources, and the IT guy doesn't necessarily want to let that get in the way of what he's doing, right there you're going to have conflict, you're going to have friction, it's going to be hard to be successful. But if you move it back out toward the business, and if you think back to what I said earlier about aligning the security objectives with the business, I think it becomes an easier sell, I think the funding becomes easier to get. And so I think enlightened organizations are going to get away from having the security function inside of IT and put it someplace else, like the CFO organization. the question was for the CSO role, do we see more external hiring or more of, you know, kind of bringing people from within the organization?
I'll give you two schools of thoughts on that. If they're truly looking for a pure CSO or CISO, they probably are going to the outside, somebody who's, you know, run an information security group at a like organization. You're probably looking on the outside rather than the inside. Also, there have been a handful of successful, or I say successful, I don't live in their organization, so I really don't know how successful they are. But there've been, you know, there's a handful of people who grab headlines, are always in magazine articles, who are, you know, as somebody says, industry names or luminaries. Those people always seem to kind of be the first ones called for positions because, you know, the person on the other end of the coin says, hey, look, you know, can you get me somebody like this? Or can you get me somebody, you know, like, you know, Joe Smith or Jane Doe or whatever. But when that position is being recruited and they're looking for somebody who's already ingrained in the business function to kind of spur the information security initiative, what they're probably looking more, as opposed to somebody who's moved up through the technical and managerial ranks, they're looking for somebody who's more of a organizational politician, somebody who can kind of pull people together and get people on the same page. So a lot of times, if they're looking for that type of a person, for that type of representation, that person is traditionally coming from the inside, just from not in the information security function.
Yeah, I'll just add one comment to that. In a couple of organizations that I've worked with, where they've gone outside and they've chosen to bring someone from the outside in, and it's worked very well. And the reason it's worked well, and back to this meeting I had with this guy last week, he was talking about an internal candidate that he wanted to kind of elevate to a CSO type of position. And he was a guy, he was in IT, and he was sort of the security guy, because like he knew more about security than anybody else, and he kind of, you know, kept a couple things up and running. But when I asked how he was viewed within the organization, the answer came back, well, you know, he's just really viewed as a whistleblower. And I said, well, right there, he's going to have a problem. You're going to elevate him to the CSO level, a job where he really needs to communicate and build consensus and sell security to the organization, and yet he's viewed as a whistleblower within the organization. So he's got a little baggage with him that might be hard to overcome, and so you might be better suited to, you know, kind of bring in a fresh perspective from the outside. But the short answer is I think the trend is bring people in from the outside. That's what I'm seeing in a lot of my clients.
To comment back on what, you know, Fred said, the whistleblower, you know, one of the reasons that information security has always gotten such a bad rap is that, and it's changed, I think it's changed a lot over the past 2-3 years, but you know, a lot of people said, wait, you can't do this, it's not secure. But wait, we have to do it, we're in business. Well, you can't do it. So a lot of these people in information security, as they, you know, people previous in the profession, had this reputation as whistleblowers, as disablers, as opposed to enablers. And I think that that's one thing that everybody has to look themselves, you know, in their job, is that, you know, understanding the core function of your business. And I think that one school of thought, when you look at your own career and you look at what's affecting you, you have to think about how important is information security to my organization? And whether that's spurred on by legislation, whether it's spurred on by the type of business that you're in, whether it's just spurred on by the, you know, just the climate, you know, the business climate that you're in at the point. But the truth is this, is that the closer that you can align information security and your position to the core business of the company, and the more times you can be recognized for enabling business, you're going to see opportunities for yourselves open up internally in your organization. You're going to see, instead of the person looking at somebody saying, oh yeah, there's Joe, he's the whistleblower. There's Joe, wow, he really helped me solve our problem and, you know, and made it so we can do business and we made more money and we had more uptime and life is good and let's have a parade for Joe. I mean, that becomes, those things are the things that you aspire to. And those are things that you couldn't even really put, I mean, you can put them on a resume, but the people who are really going to appreciate those things are the ones that are going to be the internal people. the internal people, your internal executives, your internal business leaders. They're the ones that are going to be the first ones to say attaboy, and when opportunities do come up, they're going to wind up pushing you that way.
So Lee makes a good point. There was this guy, his name was Harvey McKay, and he wrote a couple of popular business books in the 80s. What They Don't Teach You at the Harvard Business School was one of his books. And well, a lot of it was kind of fluff. He did make a very good point, and he said, look, if you really want to rise to the highest levels of the organization you work in, you have to be aligned with what that company's core competency, core business is. So you work at Nabisco. You want to rise to the top of Nabisco, you got to be in marketing. They're a marketing company. Very few companies have information security as their core business. So if you can't be in the core business, you got to be really tightly aligned with the core business. And someday you may not want to be in information security. You know, there are certainly other things you may want to do. And if you don't have that alignment with the core business, I've seen lots of people struggle to try to get out of that information security function and into something more aligned with what the business does.
Well, yeah, and one thing, you know, to expand on, I think that's an excellent point. One of the things that you should look at as in your day-to-day work, look, I know everybody works 50, 60 hours a week, I'm sure, if not more.
I don't.
What's it? I'm sure that everybody works so much, but what you need to do in your environment is you need to find time to try to get involved with business units, or I don't know if it's, you know, I wouldn't call it making friends, but trying to get involved in projects that are a little bit outside your realm so you can be exposed to more people in your organization that will help you, whether you want your career path to go right up that information security silo or into other areas of the organization. I mean, one of the great things that we have going for us today as information security professionals and in this industry, one of the great things we have going is that the skills that we've required, you know, information security cuts across all areas of technology, and technology is ingrained in every business function. So the fact that you have that knowledge, that makes you a little bit special.
I think the other thing that makes this a particularly good time to be in information security is that risk and control is in. Organizations are very focused on managing their risk, understanding their control environments, and we understand that. We understand risk, we understand control, and yeah, it's in right now. The chief executives are very focused on that.
I say, go right ahead, the front row. The question is, how do you benchmark and how do you matrix? So basically what you're saying is, how do you really determine your return on your investment to show your... If I had that answer, I wouldn't be standing here. Well, I think that, you know, the way that you can do it, I mean, the way that you can really illustrate, you know, what it is you've done, I think that, you know, you really have to make yourself visible at the right times and invisible at the wrong times. And when I say invisible at the wrong times, I'm meaning that, hey, there was a big virus attack and we didn't have any downtime. That's what I call being invisible. But when I talk about being visible, it's saying, you know, coming to the rescue, you guys have different projects and say, well, look, how, you know, what do you know, have we thought about information security? Well, this is the way I can help you make it easier. My team can make it easier for you, business leader. I know it's a recurring theme, but I think it's also important where, you know, you make sure that you become visible in a good way in your organization, and they look at you and say, wow, the chief information security officer, director of information security, they really pulled through on this. I didn't even think of this. And if we had that exposure, we could have jeopardized our business. We could have jeopardized our customers. We could jeopardize our reputation.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, if you can get in a position where people are saying, hey, the information security guys really helped us roll out this, you know, employee self-service portal that's saving us $10 million a year. I mean, that's the kind of stuff you want to be aligned with. Unfortunately, it's a little tricky. You can't just measure that by putting some variables into a spreadsheet. There's a question in the back.
Probably more, but let's say this is that, you know, one of the things that we kind of in this profession, we trap ourselves. We start saying, you know, we start quoting things from information security professional. These are our policies that we created, so we're really benchmarking this against ourselves. It's like we're grading our own tests. I mean, which is fine, but what I'm saying to you is this, is that you have to grade yourself by their tests. You have to grade yourself by the tests that they, you know, that they put forth to you. It's almost like this. People talk to me, they come up to me and they say, you know, Lee, I really feel that I'm underpaid. I really feel that I deserve more. I know what the market is earning. I saw this SAN survey, this information security magazine survey, this CSO survey. You know what kind of survey you need to show them? You need to show them something in Fortune, something in the Wall Street Journal, something on the New York Times, something on the CIO. You have to communicate where they read. You have to communicate what your management says, what is important to me as a manager, and you need to start speaking their language. That's how you start matrixing yourself. That's how you start measuring yourself, because they will do the measuring for you.
And your point is well taken, and I think it's right on. I think the trick, though, is the ability to go out to the business and say, listen, here's a risk curve. You know, here's how much it costs. Here's what we have to spend to mitigate this risk as we go along the curve. And, you know, here's the downside and the upside to spending this money. What do you, Mr. Business Owner, want to do? Where do you want to be? How much money do you want to spend? And then I'll help you do that in the most efficient way, as opposed to more of a dictatorial approach that says, here's our policy, and if you don't comply with it, you know, I'm going to ding you, or you're going to fail an audit, or something like that. It's much more of as Lee said, grading ourselves by the business's standards as opposed to our own standards.
Speak on resumes. I see thousands of them. I think that it's very good when you write a resume that you include and you start incorporating results. The first thing that I look at a resume, the first thing that grabs anybody's attention, whether they're hiring a technical position, like if Fred's hiring people for his consulting services business unit. Yes, he's going to look at tech. The first thing he's going to look at is say, what type of level of customer interaction has this person had? Can I take this person and put them in front of all my Fortune 50 type customers? Do they have the pedigree? Do they have the look? Do they have the feel? Do they have everything that goes into, and you can't, on the resume, it talks about results. You want to talk about customer service, projects led, engagements won, and that's for a consulting organization. But for an internal technical position or a chief security director, you want to really focus on results. Results is the key. Also, you know, whether it takes you one page, 2 pages, 3 pages, it doesn't matter. But you need to put together your results. The results are the most important thing. And as far as the process is concerned, let's say this. Every time we go to work with a Fortune organization, I'll walk you exactly through the process. It's really kind of funny. I'll probably have a relationship with the chief security officer or somebody in their IT department, and they'll call me up and say, Lee, we really need this. We want to use you. We heard you guys are good, da-da-da-da-da. Sign up, great. We start talking about the position. And they say, only one more thing, Lee. I need you to work with this person in human resources. They're really going to be your primary point of contact. So I'm like, okay, this is great. The chief security officer is saying, I need two or three people. They need these skill sets. We're right on the same page. This is wonderful. I go back to the HR person. The HR person starts reading me. This is how we do things here. You send this to me. If I think it's good, I will phone screen that person for 30 minutes. Then I will then send the resume to the chief security officer for their review. If they're interested or if my phone conversation notes come back negative, there will be no other interview. And then I get back on the phone with the chief security officer. I don't know if we can work with you. And then they kind of have a sit down and whatever happens, happens. But the truth of the matter is that you can't circumvent that process because HR is queen bee in those organizations. So if you're interested in a position, this is what you kind of have to do. You see there's a posting, you know that there's a job that exists. Send your resume to the HR person. Instead of just sending it on the internet, follow up with a hard copy. Follow up with a hard copy. People have to kind of open their mail, which is the way it kind of goes. And they get 30, they're working on tons of different jobs. And the emails just kind of run together. And this is, you know, information security. This search might be one of 15, 20 searches that she's working on anyway. So it doesn't really matter there. But then after you submit, and let's say you get no response for 3 or 4 weeks, what you do is you get on the phone, call the HR person. Said, I submitted my resume. I wonder if, you know, we'd spend some time. If they don't respond to you, which they probably will not, what you need to do is get on the phone, call the chief security officer, figure out, do a little bit of social engineering on your own, find out who that person is, get on the phone and say, look, I wanted to talk to you. I submitted my resume to your organization about 10 days ago. I wanted to go through your process because I respect the fact that your company has processes. However, I've gotten no response, and I definitely believe that I can help you. I'd like to spend 15 minutes on the phone with you just to talk to you about what it is that I believe I can bring to your organization. I will do my call on your schedule. You let me know. So right then, you're showing that prospective employer, you're showing them that you understand process, you're showing them initiative, and you're showing them flexibility. And you're doing that in a very, very professional manner. And you know what? Then it's up to you. You know, you got to get in the door. And I think in this market, people rely on the internet. People rely on recruiters. They quit relying on themselves. I hear people call me up all the time. Well, I just got laid off, and all I did today was fire off 80 resumes. Well, look, it's the same type of thought process that you put into hitting send 80 times on your, what's even better yet, sometimes they don't send 80 different emails. They send one email to 80 different addresses. So people call us up, and you know, when they send it to a recruiter, it's all the recruiters that they send it to. So why didn't you call me back? I said, look, I said, I figured I'd wait for the other 13 recruiters to call you back before we did. Well, why? Well, because if you don't think much about working with me, why should we think that much about working together with you? And that's, so, you know, you're going to get out of it what you put into it. And I'm going to tell you, there's tons of clutter out there. And resumes alone, keywords, all that stuff, not getting the job done in this market. It's too competitive. There are too many people who have done that job before that are not working today and will do it for less than they were earning beforehand because they went from earning 150, 180 to zero. They got mortgages, they got car payments, they got college tuitions, they got everything to worry about. So it's very competitive, and you have to differentiate yourself. That's the most important thing I can. If you leave here with one thing, you need to differentiate yourselves internally, and you need to differentiate yourselves externally. Look for different things to do. Look for conferences to present at. Look for different things, organizations to be a part of. Do things within your organization. Make yourself more visible so it benefits you.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that's almost like a chicken and an egg situation, because what I've found, the organizations that I've been working with have said, man, we spent $10 million on security last year, and that stupid thing called SQL Slammer still hit us. Something's not working. And they've taken a step back, and they haven't really done it in the context of my budget or how much more or less I want to spend. They've looked at what they've spent, and they said, have I really gotten $10 million worth of value out of that? And if they think the answer is no, they're looking to bring someone in to figure out, you know, how to spend it better, smarter, more efficiently. So that's the experience that I've had over the last, 12 to 18 months.
What I've seen is this, is that when organizations are recruiting for chief security officers, a lot of times one of the most important things that that chief security officer will negotiate as they're doing their salary is what the budget's going to be. And I'm not saying that they can negotiate it effectively. They're not even a member of the organization. But that's part of, you know, that's probably one of the main reasons that people don't take those jobs, is because they realize that they're going to walk into a situation where they're going to wind up with a bullseye on their back. So I think that, you know, if you are interviewing for those types of positions, I think it's clear that throughout, and if you interview for a chief security officer position, you will interview with a lot of people that have some very significant decision-making authority, and you should ask them the same question. What do you think the budget is going to be for this year and the next year? And if those answers are all over the board, your red flag should go up very quickly. It should go up very quickly. Because budgets will ultimately, you know, budgets mean two things, three things. Number one, first of all, budgets determine how serious your organization is about the, you know, about security. It'll also determine what your long-term career path will be after you become and succeed as the chief security officer. And I think the third thing, and this is probably more dealing with quality of life, is that the lower the budget, the less people you have to help you. Externally, internally, and that means the more burden's going to be on your head. The more weekends you're going to work, the more times you're not going to get home till 8:30, 9:30 at night. I mean, that comes along with $200,000 salaries, and you have to accept that. But if you have no budget, it's going to be worse. I guarantee that. I guarantee it.
Yeah, you've got that, you know, the old, you know, definition of a consultant—the guy who borrows your watch to tell you what time it is—and so there's a bit of a bias that you talk a good game, but you really haven't done anything, right? And so where I've seen people be successful is exactly what Lee had said earlier: is, you know, you got to show. I helped my client save $10 million because I implemented an identity management solution. Or I help my client, you know, avoid SQL Slammer because, you know, we set up, you know, an intrusion. You have to show that you got your hands dirty, that you got inside an organization, and that you actually did something that added some value, as opposed to the misconception that you showed up, they told you everything that was wrong, you put it on, you know, bond paper and handed it back to them. I think that's the key is, you know, the facts are the facts, and you really have to highlight that when you talk to people. And you're absolutely right. There's a bias right out of the gate, and you have to fight hard to overcome that.
The one reason I always ask, well, why won't you consider a consultant? Well, they've never taken ownership of a situation. They come, they fix the problem, then they leave. I need somebody who's ingrained in my organization. So what you need to show, instead of giving a list of, you know, what you might want to do after on your resume, after you put together your major accomplishments, you might want to include a second document, maybe one page, maybe two, consulting projects that I've worked for while I was at PricewaterhouseCoopers. And then you can say, you know, for a large financial services customer, for an, over a four-month period, I Then they ask me to come back 6 months later to help them with something else. If you can show repeat work as a customer, you know, with the same client, that's actually very good. It shows that you have more of a, you know, a little bit more of a tie than, you know, one of these guys that comes in, does some, you know, A&P work and, you know, checks out a Dodge and comes back a year later to do the same thing.
I've always been impressed when I, and okay, so I'm obviously looking for consultants, but I've always been impressed when I see people who do, you know, one guy had a thing, he said something like, examples of solving complex business problems. And then he had like five or six paragraphs about projects that he had done. And, you know, one was he had saved a company $1 million by, I don't know, reevaluating some encryption thing that they were doing. And he talked about how, I mean, just, you know, examples of solving complex business problems. He had five or six of them listed there. And I thought, man, this is, you know, this is pretty impressive.
Go ahead. Let me ask this question before I answer that. You know, we have very interesting titles in our industry. When you say a senior security analyst, how many years of experience are you talking about with like a person? Comp range? Where do you live? I'll give you a comp range. Where are you from? Where's your organization based? Not your name. Yeah, where are you based? In California? You're probably somewhere, you know, 75 to 95 in that range, depending. The one thing I would tell you, because you're looking for somebody who can kind of handle both functions, what you might want to do, what you might want to do is this, is that, do you think that there's, will this be the only person in your organization? It'll be you and that person, or do you have a broader organization? Okay, then you know what you want to do is this, is that you want to find somebody who might be a little bit junior in both of those areas, but has a combination. Maybe somebody who's worked as like a senior consultant at a big X firm. Fred, you know anybody? No. Maybe a senior consultant at a big X firm, maybe somebody who's worked at one of these startup, you know, pre-IPO information security consulting type companies, because they've had some customer experience, they've had some technical experience, and it might not be that 5 or 6 years that you're searching for, but you can probably tell them different things about your organization as opposed to what they're doing. They probably won't have to travel 80-90% of the time. You get to go to conferences like the Black Hat briefings, which is a good thing. It'll just be the two of you in the department. So, look, if good things happen for you, this person's going to become the head guy over there. So you have so many different things that you can tell this person that if you get somebody who's really passionate, you know, everybody talks about resume. Everybody talks about skills and all those things. One thing that we forget to look at when we're hiring people is kind of what they're what their makeup is, why they're doing the job that they're doing. Are they passionate about it? You know, do they take their work home with them? Is it an avocation to them as well as a vocation? And that doesn't have to be a requirement, but if you can find somebody who might not have the right skill sets, but you can really present them with an opportunity, And I'm sure you have some strengths where you can mentor that person, whether it's technically, whether it's dealing with the business people. I think that you'll be pleasantly surprised. You'll probably wind up paying less. The person will probably appreciate the opportunity more and take ownership. But when you only can hire one person, you better be sure it's right. You better be sure that person's right. Because you might, the person comes on and then goes away, you might not get a second shot to hire another person.
You know, the only thing I would add to that, because we struggle with that a lot in our organization too, is that my experience has been it is usually easier to teach people technical skills than it is to teach them soft skills. And so if you can find someone who already has the good writing, communication, you know, the presence, I think you got a better shot of molding that person into the balance of technical and soft skills that you want. I think it's hard to teach people those skills if they don't have them already. Fun here? The question was where do we see computer forensics going?
I think it's a hot space. I think that, you know, when you're starting to deal with things, when you start seeing more legislation, you start seeing more trust issues come up, and you start seeing the board of directors get more involved in companies and, you know, what's happening in our control of our organization. I believe that forensics is definitely going to be a completely emerging space. I think that it's done in, you know, big companies now or in specific instances, but I wouldn't be surprised if you started seeing, you know, people selling computer forensic services almost as they sell legal services almost on retainer. I think that's a natural bridge between those two.
Most of my clients are getting very serious about that from two perspectives. One, they're really aggravated when they have an attack or a hack or somebody breaks in, and they're really being very much more aggressive about trying to track it down and prosecute. And then to Lee's point, because of some of the legislation we have to deal with, you really need to be in a position to go back and recover things like emails and Word documents and other things. So I would tend to agree with Lee. I've seen it. My clients are getting very serious about it. That is an enormous, at least in my opinion, an enormously complex question with an equally complex answer that we could spend a lot of time debating the merits of. I will say this, though. You have to look at it from a risk-reward perspective. In other words, am I taking a certain amount of risk by hiring a person with questionable credentials, and am I the reward I'm going to get for that worth the risk that I might be taking? And then the next question you have to say is, you know, how comfortable do I feel presenting this person to my clients or to my board or to my boss? And then you just, at that point, you just have to make a decision whether or not you think the skills that that person is bringing to the table are worth whatever potential downside you might have to that. I mean, I think that's the simplest way to look at it.
I think a lot of the things that you say, you know, how does somebody define a black hat? I always believe in my own mind is that how I define people that we won't work or we won't represent because they represent liability issues to my company is that we won't represent people who have been convicted of a computer-related felony. That's how I define it. Now, in my own thought process is I always believe that now, you could have been 16, 17, 18 years old and done something wrong. We've all done things that are foolish at that age. You know, I always believe that if someone gives back to the community or to the information security twice what the damage that they cause, that, to me, in my own mind, that they've kind of expunged themselves and, you know, they've become a little bit, you know, ethically speaking, you know, people change, people evolve. If you do, you know, when Fred says risk reward, the ultimate risk for you in hiring somebody of questionable background is your job. So, you know, when you're doing that, or if you own a company, or if you're a, you know, if you're a software or a services company, how much is your reputation worth?
I think the other side of that is, you know, if you're the 16, 17-year-old you know, hacker, for instance, you know, you may not realize it at the time, but you're making certain decisions that may further down the road preclude other decisions. And so that's not necessarily a bad thing, but you have to understand that certain actions that you take may prevent you from doing other things that you want to do later on in your career. So, yeah, it does get a little bit complex, but I think you have to look at what kind of risk am I taking and what's the payback that I'm going to get for that risk, and then make make an intelligent decision. Someone once asked me, this was a couple of years ago, they said, would you ever hire Kevin Mitnick to work for your company? And I said, no. And I said, but the reason I said no might surprise you. And they said, well, because he's been convicted and he went to jail. I said, no, it's not at all. Guy hasn't touched a computer in 5 years. I don't think he's got any good hacking skills that I can use anymore. And I think they were very surprised by the fact that, you know, he had been convicted and been in jail, had very little to do with my thoughts on whether or not he would be appropriate for my organization. You just have to look at what you're getting and whether or not you're taking on any risk by doing that.
Toughest search out there. Toughest search out there. You know what the problem is when you have the people with the job, you know, with the those technical skills, they don't have the security skills. And when you have the people with the security skills, you know, they've been to a couple training classes, but they really don't have those. Because the reason, and I'll tell you the reason why that hasn't happened yet, is that because information security departments, you must work in an organization that's very proactive when it comes down to information security. It really sounds like it. Because most organizations can't afford to have a person, you know, he's talking about being able to hire one security analyst, and you're talking about being able to hire one of the most specialized skill sets that are out there. I mean, right there is a tremendous, you know, how many people are in your security organization, sir? Four. And you can hire, that's very interesting. I mean, that's very proactive. You know, that's one of the reasons a lot of these, the consulting firms have done very well, is that, you know, all these folks are kind of hoarded in four or five firms that kind of do this and do this well. And there are also a lot of independent consultants, you know, that are floating around. Web application security. You're talking about like web application security, penetration testing, and reverse engineering, secure code reviews. The hottest skill on the market.
Can't you just run AppScan to do that?
We do get that a lot, though. But, I'm not going to give you my own infomercial, but... I mean, but the truth is that you're 100% right. It is a nationwide search. You need to be very open when it comes down to compensation. You need to actually, you know, look, a lot of people that have this skill, we talk about black hat, you know, and into that understanding, yeah. I mean, that's a big deal too, you know. You know, you have to understand if that person is going to wind up fitting. A lot of times some of these guys, you know, some of these folks that do this are not long-term players too. They come in, get bored, they want to do something else. So very, very rare skill set. Right?
I interviewed a guy for a similar thing, a web application, and I asked him, I said, you know, how'd you get your skills? Where'd you learn? And he said, I started by trying to hack porn sites. And I said, oh, man. I said, you know, I just don't know if you're going to fit in our organization. It's hard
You're
to find.
Yeah,
it's hard to find. Other questions?
Any other questions? thought we were going to make it without a certification question. There's no substitute for experience. I don't want to get on a soapbox because I'm sure people hold certain certifications that are out there, but I think one of the things, to answer your question, experience is key. I can always get over certification issues with my customers as opposed to experience issues. So, I mean, I can always say, well, the person has great skills, but they're not a CISSP like you asked for, but they're qualified. If you sponsor them, they'll wind up taking the test. Person's just been too busy to get it. A lot of the best people, I'm going to say a lot of the best people, I got to be careful what I say. There are a lot of great people that are uncertified. They might be certifiable, but they're uncertified. When it comes down to it is that I don't use that as a benchmark. I do think this, and I'll use this to be my little soapbox, is that when the CISSP has grown from, when I started in 1997, couple hundred people, to 12,000-13,000 people. They had a 15-year-old take the test and pass it. I mean, that's not policing your certification. As an industry, people are watering down that certification, and we don't even realize it. And that's the biggest thing. And if anybody here is a CISSP, I think it's your duty to go to the organization that you paid money to, that you took classes for, that you passed the test with, that you hold that certification, that you take continuing educational credits for, that you go back to them and say, I want my certification to mean more. And the truth is, it's a checkbox. It's like an MCSE. And it's not, might be opening a door on a keyword search, but that's it.
I mean, the only thing I would add to that is, look, I think that if you take the time to go and get a certification, I mean, I think that's indicative of how serious you take your career and your passion for what we do. But at the end of the day, I'll always take a guy with experience over a guy with certification. So I view it as it's a nice to have, but I want to see the dirty hands. I want to see that the guy's done some stuff.
I mean, let me say this, is that, you know what, if you have a star that's underpaid and you lose them, it's your fault. Regardless of what, people always, what was the person earning before, look, blanket statement, your next job will always be predicated on your past earnings. It's just the way it is. But the truth is that, if you take somebody and you bring them into your organization, it's almost kind of like HR revenge and IT's revenge on all the people, all the 22-year-olds that held them up for $110,000 with Java development skills in 1996 to 1997 and tons of stock options. We're going to get the IT people back. That's the mentality. But the truth is that if you have somebody in your organization that's underpaid and they're valuable, you're doing yourself a disservice. So, that's kind of your own risk. If you're cheap and you know you're being cheap, you got a problem. You got a problem. Go ahead. I wish them well. I'm not the place to go to for that. Very simple, and if we did do a search like that, I wouldn't guarantee the person. I wouldn't guarantee everybody. So,
I mean, put yourself in that guy's position for a minute too, because when you do that, and when you do that, the guy comes on board. He knows he's underpaid, but he needs the job. What's he going to spend the next year doing? Is he going to spend the next year, helping you build information security, or is he going to spend the next year trying to find his next job?
You're also doing this, and I think organizations have a horrible way of doing it. Maybe it is a little bit of a revenge factor. But, you know, you break somebody's spirit when you just undervalue them. I mean, that's just, I mean, it's just a little bit demeaning. You know, I have people call me up that I know that have been out of work for a while, and they're good people with great skills. They're just in very weird locations. And maybe they got a, you know, maybe they jumped on the opportunity bus a couple, too many times during the boom and the tech bubble. But you listen to these people talk. And I have a guy who I know really, really well, CTO of a software company that did pretty well, earning about, I don't know, $120,000, $130,000 with a bunch of options and stuff like that. One of my customers who had interviewed him and then he couldn't relocate for them sends me an email saying that you know, his resume is on Monster, he's willing to accept $80,000. And my customer says, wow, you think he can come work with us and stay where he is for $80,000? I said, I won't do that to him. I said, I just won't. I just, you can't do that to people, you know. One of the things I just kind of lead in is that, you know, whether you're hiring people or you're working for a company, the one thing everybody needs to remember is that at the end of the day, you don't work for the company. You work for the person that you interact with. And if you're managing people, you should treat them like you would want to be treated, and vice versa. Because you never know when one day you're going to be in that bad situation and you're going to need a favor and that person's going to be on the other side of the desk. You meet the same people on the way up as you do on the way down. And you just can't forget that. So I think that you really have to understand is that at the end of the day, in employment situations, it's people. That's it. Organizations will come and go. The people stay constant. Are you, I'm trying to understand the question. Are you, do you mean that like a person who's working as an independent consultant and has, or, okay. So how much experience, how much information security experience is significant?
I think it depends a lot on the organization, though. I've got some clients where, you know, one guy, you know, half-time is sufficient, and I've got other clients where they could probably use three people full-time just to, you know, just to oversee the thing. So I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, but I think it's a function of the size and complexity and risk tolerance of the organization.
I just think that... you know, if you're asking from a personal perspective also, you know, for you, in other words, how much security work do I need, you know, maybe what I should do to make sure that I still have that security quota filled, is that part of your question or am I misreading it? Oh, okay. Understand.
I mean, when we talk about moving the security function out of IT, the short answer is it really depends on the organization. I hate to fall back to that. But when we talk about moving, at least when I talk about moving security out of IT, I'm talking about, you know, driving the vision, driving the budget, you know, just driving the overall strategy for the overall security strategy of the organization. where you do ID administration or firewall logging, I mean, every company's different, and yeah, for the most part, that's probably best suited to sit inside of IT because you need to understand the devices that you're interacting with in order to do that. When you start talking about how that interacts with the strategy and the vision, that's when you want to start to get that, I think, away from the IT realm.
I also think that, as some of this managed security services technology, I think that you'll see a trend maybe a little bit more to outsourcing some of the quote-unquote grunt work functions, the log analysis, I think that you'll see somewhat of a trend to do that, to outsource the day-to-day tasks and to keep the strategy, architecture, and implementation type tasks, as corporate functions and to outsource the other type of functions. The one trend that I'll tell you, like I said, web application security is a hot trend. But I mean, the one thing that I tell you is that they all have some sort of an in-depth technical background. They've all have worked in some sort of customer service or consultative type background where their nature is flexible. They have very broad experiences, and they're traditionally not what I would consider, complete generalists. They normally have one pocket of strength, whether it's architecture, whether it's implementation, whether it's Unix, whether it's Microsoft security, whatever it might be. And I think, I think the last thing is that they enjoy what they do. I had one customer who said to me, he says, you know what? Find me another guy who has a lab in their home. Cool. I always know when I'm talking to somebody and say, I got three Unix machines, an NT server, da 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 da. I'm like, cha-ching. That's, we have somebody who knows what they're doing. I mean, and look, that doesn't mean everybody has to go out and build a security lab in their house. I mean, but it's, you just want to see kind of where their source of inspiration comes from and why they like doing what they're doing. So, I've been doing, I got an organization of six people, doing this for 7 years. I mean, just all over, they're just there. I mean, they're all out there. It's so funny because this is an industry where there's so many good people that are out there, just kind of matching them up as to what they're looking for, what they want. It's completely different. It's a very interesting process. Very interesting. A lot of factors have to go in to make something fit right, and very few factors have to go into destroying it. So.
Well, I think with that, we promised we'd get you guys out of here in time for lunch. So, on behalf of Lee and myself, I'd like to thank you for coming. Thanks for your participation. It certainly makes things a lot easier for us. And I think both of us will be around for a few minutes if you have any other questions. Thank you.
Thank you.